Next up on This Week in Law, startup attorney Joe Wallen joins Sarah and me. We're going to talk about startup law and crowdfunding and what having $1 million and being over 13 have in common. Happy birthday. The song is moving closer to the public domain. And be careful, Twitter's cracking down on stolen jokes. Next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 313, recorded July 31st, 2015. Just a DIY bill. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payments solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/twill. And by Veridesk. Convert your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk. Veridesk is height adjustable and lets you easily switch between sitting and standing. To learn more, visit Veridesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-Desk.com. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you are joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited that you've joined us this week. We've got a great panel of folks. We're very excited to get to some topics that have been much in the news lately at the intersection of technology and law. Joining us from Olympia, Washington, and the law firm of Carney, Badley & Spellman is Joe Wallen. Hello, Joe.
Hi. Great to talk to you. Actually in Seattle, not Olympia.
I pulled up your website. Maybe you have an Olympia office. That's what I saw.
Yeah,
so if you need legal services in either Seattle or Olympia, Washington,
It's true.
Joe's firm is ready to cover all your needs. Great to have you, Joe. Joe is also a colleague of Mike Schneider, who we had on the show just a few episodes ago, and they do the Law of Startups blog and podcast. So we're going to be talking today a lot about startup issues and law, but not before I introduce and welcome back to the show my co-host, Sarah Pearson. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Denise. Happy to be here.
Great to see you, Sarah. Sarah, of course, is Senior Counsel for Creative Commons and has been working a lot. How's your Kickstarter project going?
It's going pretty well. We're at maybe 67%, something like that. We've got 2 weeks left. So
that's awesome. And remind folks why you're doing a Kickstarter.
Yeah, we are raising money to write a book about business models that involve Creative Commons licensing. We're calling them open business models. It's going pretty well. It's fun. It's been an interesting experience doing crowdfunding for the first time.
Yes, and we're going to be talking about crowdfunding with Joe, who happens to be an expert on that topic. In fact, why don't we just go ahead and launch right into that?
Okay.
Victor, I'm not sure what happened there, but it sounded like the turntable was one speed too slow on the bumper. If you even remember how that sounds, because I don't know if you've probably heard of turntable in a very long time. But anyway, let's talk about the policy issues around crowdfunding. Joe actually was the originator of Washington State's crowdfunding law. There are a few, let's set the table here a little bit for folks who haven't been following this issue all that closely. We have a federal crowdfunding act called the Jobs Act that was passed, what was it, now 2 years ago, Joe?
Yeah, you know, I think the Jobs Act was 2012, wasn't it?
Oh gosh, yeah, so 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It is still trying to get sorted out by the SEC and regulators. And of course, various states have decided, well, the federal act is not perfect for us, so we're going to do our own thing. And that Washington is among them, correct?
Yes. So yeah, you know, it's a funny story. I, you know, when the Jobs Act was, you know, being, you know, bandied about Congress or whatnot, I was following it pretty closely. And so, you know, the Senate sort of mangled the Title III. And so I think if you don't recall, like, exactly what happened, the House passed a perfectly, you know, great Jobs Act. And then they sent it to the Senate, and the Senate took everything the House did except for Title III. It took out the House's Title III and inserted its own, and basically threw in like every, you know, regulatory protective measure it could dream up, and then sent it back to the House, and the House passed it again. So the Jobs Act that passed, the Title III, you know, crowdfunding provisions in the Jobs Act aren't very satisfying because they are too complex and expensive. And so the trouble with the Title III, you know, federal statute is just, it's just too complex. And what you run into in the law, if you're a securities lawyer, is the law books are, you know, littered with securities law exemptions of one kind or another, most of which are never used because they're impractical or too difficult to use. And that's why I think the stat is something like 90%+ of all private company security offerings are done under what's called Rule 506. So all accredited investor offerings under Rule 506, because the legal complexities of a 506 offering are manageable. And in fact, as long as you take money from only accredited investors, you know, you can't commit fraud, obviously, but you also don't have any specific information requirements. So you can go out and raise money with like a pitch deck or an executive summary and a term sheet. And then once you have investor interest, you know, lined up, then you can call your lawyer and say, hey, we're ready to close on the one-page term sheet that summarizes the terms of the deal that you helped us prepare. We have investors ready to write checks. Can you prepare the documents? Then your lawyer can prepare the documents when you know you've got the money committed. And then you can close, you know, get simple accredited investor certifications from investors, and then file your Form D with the SEC within 15 days of closing. And so the legal cost and complexity of an all accredited investor offering is very manageable from a company's perspective. And one nice thing about it that I don't think regulators or legislators understand is basically you don't have to go deep into hawk spending money on legal and accounting fees for a deal you might not get. And that, so that's really nice. But the Jobs Act Title III, it creates a situation where companies are going to spend a lot of money to do a crowdfunding, and they're not going to know in advance whether or not they're actually going to be able to succeed. So it's a really unfortunate situation. So what I was doing around 2012 is I was writing about how disappointing it was, the federal act. And then one morning I woke up and I thought, hey, we should write our own Jobs Act crowdfunding law for the state of Washington. And I actually wrote one and I posted it on my blog. And then I've got the folks at GeekWire, the sort of local tech magazine here in Seattle, to rerun my blog post. And then coincidentally, I sort of befriended a state legislator in Washington State who invited me down to the state capitol to testify with a bunch of other people about how to make Washington a better place to do business. So I went down there with the bill I wrote and posted on my blog, and I talked about crowdfunding and why I thought it'd be a great idea if Washington did it. And after that sort of legislative hearing, it was like a working group session, like several legislators came up to me and said, hey, can I have that bill you wrote? We want to sponsor that bill.
And so I said, excellent.
Sure, you can have the bill. Here it is. And then it just so happened that year in 2012, the Washington legislature was already sort of past the budget deadline when it got sponsored. And so, but we were lucky that the state legislators who were interested in the bill, especially Cyrus Habib, who was a startup lawyer before he became a state legislator, he worked sort of during the off season of the legislative session. In Washington, we have a 60-day legislative, 60 days 1 year, and then like 105 days during the budget years. So they're really short legislative cycles. And so in any event, Cyrus worked with like the state securities regulators and other stakeholders to take the sort of draft crowdfunding bill that I wrote on my blog, which was, the bill I wrote was sort of a libertarian fantasy bill. And so other stakeholders were able to chime in, and they basically, built the bill out to make it less of a fantasy, more of a bill that other people could live with. And so, in any event, it was fun. The Washington legislature passed it then, and the following legislative cycle. And then that bill that I wrote, I mean, a bunch of states, like 15 to 20, I think now, have passed crowdfunding laws. And I mean, they're all somewhat similar to one another, and somewhat similar to the federal bill, although they try to make it easier on companies to actually be able to use the law, I think is the primary differentiator between the state laws and the federal laws. So most of these state statutes are pretty short. I mean, you're talking like maybe a page of legislative language as opposed to what you see in the federal law, which is like multiple pages of complex stuff that people aren't going to be able to afford to do.
Right. Wow, that is such a great anecdote. I would never have thought when I started blogging back in 2001 that, several years later, a decade or so later, someone would post draft legislation to their blog and it would get adopted by several states. It's just a neat story.
Fun. Yeah, it's a pretty fun thing. So,
yeah. What were you going to say, Sarah?
Oh, I was going to just say, for somebody who didn't even take securities law in law school, can you kind of jump up a level?
I didn't either,
by
the way.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't touched it in my practice either. So I feel like I know almost literally nothing about it. Can you kind of talk a little bit about who these laws apply to and how they interact, just at a really basic level?
Yeah.
Right. And then one other thing I think you should clarify for our non-lawyer listeners is the difference between the kind of crowdfunding that Sarah's doing, it's the Creative Commons is doing, where you're raising money to build a specific thing, and the people supporting you are helping you build that thing. Maybe they get a copy of the thing, maybe they get a sticker, maybe they get your thanks, but what they're not getting is equity. And the kind of crowdfunding that you're talking about, where you are getting an equity stake in a company.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and so there's basically two different types of crowdfunding. One is non-equity crowdfunding, so Kickstarter, Indiegogo, other sites like that. Basically, what you're doing is you're pre-selling a good or pre-selling something. So you're not selling a stake in the business. You're not selling like a royalty share in the movie that's going to be made. You might be pre-selling like a screening to the movie, or you might be pre-selling copies of the movie on a disc or something, but you're not selling any equity stake in the business. And so that's been, obviously wildly successful. I think Kickstarter's had more than $1 billion like flow through Kickstarter. And that was as of like, I think last year. So I don't know what their dollar number is now. But I mean, it's really an amazing transformative thing that's going on in the economy that allows people to. And the great thing about, say you're going to do a Kickstarter and you're going to try to make a gadget. Say, we came up with an idea to build some sort of gadget of some kind. The great thing about crowdfunding is you can find out whether the world at large has any interest in what you're doing. It used to be sort of in the old days, if we had an idea, we would maybe go raise a bunch of money, spend several years building it, and then go out to see if anyone cared. And frequently at the end of that, period where we collected all that money and then spent it all creating a thing, we'd find out, oh, well, it wasn't what the market wanted. But today you can go out with a Kickstarter campaign. You can find out quickly if people are interested at all. So it's pretty cool. You can sort of validate your idea. And then I've talked to friends and clients who have done Kickstarter campaigns that have failed, but they have learned a tremendous amount by failing. And so in other words, there's a great community on Kickstarter, and they can learn a lot from that community about, well, what does the community actually want? So then they can go back to the drawing board and build something that's more in line with what people want. So Kickstarter is awesome, obviously. It's non-equity. Indiegogo is non-equity. And if you read their terms of service, and Kickstarter, by the way, has got great terms of service, like written, the lawyers who wrote those did an exceptional job. So this other sort of segment of crowdfunding is so-called equity crowdfunding, and it has yet to realize its full potential. A lot of people are excited about it because of what they've seen happen on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or whatnot. And the thinking is, well, gee, you know, if we can give people an equity stake in these businesses, things can get really exciting. Of course, in the securities law, there's a lot of prohibitions on what you can and can't do, how you can do things. It's basically like a bunch of complex sort of rules to the road. And so
it's sort of ironic. It's incredibly expensive to get investors.
It is. It is. And that's one of the quandaries. Like I work with a lot of small or a lot of brand new, you know, startup companies, and they might be typically they're founded by people who are really smart at their particular thing, their domain. If it's software or if it's something technical or scientific, they're really like awesome at that. But they've never spent time raising money for a company. Like, many of them are first-time founders who've never spent time raising money for a company. So these folks end up spending an inordinate amount of time connecting to the investment community, which is too bad because all that time they spend, you know, doing that, they could spend their time like building something. But the law sets up these barriers to getting to investors. So before the Jobs Act, if you were going to do a Rule 506 offering, you could not advertise that offering. You could not tweet about it, post it on LinkedIn, post it on Facebook. The old Rule 506, which is now called Rule 506B, and now we have a Rule 506C too, but Rule 506B prohibits general solicitation or general advertising. So you basically have to work, you know, from one contact that you know to another contact that you know. So work through your pre-existing contacts. And so that just takes a lot of time. It's very labor intensive and it's not great for startup companies or founders because of the time required. So when Congress passed the Jobs Act, Section 201 of the Jobs Act said, hey, look, if you're raising money from only accredited investors, you can go ahead and generally solicit, but right, you can only take money from accredited only.
Explain who that is. Who's an accredited investor?
So these are $1 million net worth, $1 million net worth people excluding their primary residence, or people with incomes of at least 200 grand for the last 2 years with the expectation of the same in the year of investment, or with their spouse, $300,000 in income. So that's generally your accredited investor pool. And so those numbers were set back in, I think, 1982, something like that. They were set a long time ago. And from time to time, legislation will be introduced to sort of retroactively adjust those numbers to inflation. Dodd-Frank instructed the SEC to take a look at those numbers every like 4 years to determine whether or not they should be adjusted. And so it's kind of an existential issue because like I think one of the early versions of the Dodd-Frank bill would have retroactively readjusted those numbers to inflation from like 1982 to today. And that would have, you know, wiped out like 3/4 of all eligible accredited investors who are the angel investors in America who help these companies get started. So anyway, that's kind of an issue that bounces around from time to time.
Right. And this is going to be a weird analogy, but bear with me here, because as you're explaining this, I'm thinking that being an accredited investor is for regulatory and communications purposes very akin to being age 13 and up in the United States. So it's sort of this threshold where if you're going to operate under the threshold, here it's a financial threshold for purposes of COPPA, it's an age threshold.
Right.
If you're going to operate under that threshold, it gets very complicated and expensive and so onerous that that people choose not to do it.
Yeah, that's an absolutely fair analogy. You sort of step off a cliff. In fact, what a lot of people do is when they read the rules, so they go to the rule book and they open up Rule 506 and they start reading it, and then they see in Rule 506 a statement that, oh, hey, look, under Rule 506B it says I can take up to 35 non-accredited investors in my round, and then they stop reading and they think, oh, I can take up to 35 non-accredits. But if you keep reading, what you find out is if you even take one non-accredited investor, you've got to provide like registered offering level disclosure. And that means you don't do it. That means you stick to all accredited investors only because it's too expensive. It's like stepping off a cliff and all of a sudden you're spending a fortune on legal and accounting fees. And if you're a startup company, you don't have any money to spend.
Mm-hmm. Great. So we're cranking along. We have the Jobs Act out there, which is still getting ironed out and maybe a little too complicated as written and promulgated, and it seems like the SEC is still giving people guidance on how to operate under the Jobs Act. You very cleverly posted a state version on your blog that is getting picked up not only by the state of Washington, where it was revised and enacted, but other states have been following suit. How does that play with the Jobs Act? For our non-lawyer audience members, federal and state laws can regulate in the same area, but if they come into direct conflict, the federal law prevails. So where does that leave us with these competing state and federal crowdfunding laws?
Sure. So when I was like dreaming up my state law, I was trying to identify a basis on which we could avoid the federal law, right? Because if we don't avoid the federal law, we haven't accomplished anything. And so the sort of basis I dreamed up was Section 3A11 of the Securities Act of 1933. So this was a section that was actually put in place like when the Securities Act was enacted. So go back to 1933. And Section 3A11 says something along the lines of, hey, the Securities Act doesn't apply to offerings that are purely within a state. And then the SEC has issued rules saying, well, what that means is that if you have like a Washington State corporation and you have residents of Washington State investing in that Washington corporation, and that Washington corporation's business is predominantly a local business, and there's some financial ratios like 80% of your revenue or 80% of your business is done within the state of Washington in this example, well, then the Securities Act of 1933 doesn't apply. So that was the basis on which when I drafted my state crowdfunding law, I was trying to avoid the federal law. And so 3A11 works okay. And I think of all the states that have enacted state crowdfunding laws, almost all of them have relied on 3A11. But Maine did something interesting and I think good. Maine said, hey, there is another basis on which to avoid the federal law, and that is under Rule 504 of Regulation D, promulgated under the Securities Act. If you go through a state registration process, you also avoid the federal Securities Act as long as you go through a state registration process in a state which has a registration process. And so in other words, if you have a state law which allows you to register securities, then under Rule 504, you can raise up to $1 million in 12 months and avoid the federal crowdfunding bill. So there are two bases on which states can rely to avoid the federal crowdfunding law when they enact their own crowdfunding law. And Washington State initially based its law on 3A11. And 3A11 has those limitations I mentioned, which is, you know, it has to be a local business incorporated here, investors here. And those are kind of restrictions that are not ideal, because what happens if you're a Delaware corporation and you want to accept, you know, investors from maybe Oregon and Washington? Well, under 3A11, you're stuck and you can't do that. So Rule 504 is this other, you know, basis on which you can proceed if your state law allows for it. So in Washington State, even though the statute, the crowdfunding statute that was enacted, was initially based on 3A11, the state regulators also issued guidance that said, hey, you can use the state crowdfunding form as a registration statement under Rule 504. So in this state, we can do it either way, Rule 504 or 3A11. Of course, this state's laws, despite the best effort to create a law that was usable by companies, once we were done going through the process of adopting regulations, we ended up with some regulations that make that, you know, state equity crowdfunding here in Washington State not as simple as I would like it to be. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. We've talked about this on the show before in the context of the Jobs Act, not so much the various state complements or answers to it. And the issue that always comes up, and the reason that the 1933 Act of our securities laws exists in the first place, is consumer protection, anti-fraud. We want companies to be able to raise money in a way that makes sense and doesn't involve too much irony in how much money you have to spend in order to raise your money.
Right.
But at the same time, we don't want people taken in by snake oil salesmen who are putting out a mythical product or product they either can't deliver or don't intend to, or whatever it is they're doing, if they're, you know, out and out committing fraud, or they're just not good business people.
Right.
And taking in a whole lot of investors, even accredited ones. So how did you try and strike that balance in the proposed law that you came up with, and how has Washington dealt with that issue in its final law?
Yeah. Well, one of the big complaints I've had about the federal law, and I think other people have had too, is, so let's suppose that we were startup company founders, or we're a startup company founding team, the three of us, and we want to go raise $1 million to build whatever it is we want to build. Well, what we would do is we would have to go out ourselves, like whoever our CEO was. In this case, if it was you, Denise, you were the CEO and I was the, who knows what I am, but maybe I'm the back-end engineer or something. who knows? And maybe Sarah's like the front-end designer or something, but you're the CEO. I mean, you would go out and you would raise the money yourself, and you would never call a broker and say, hey, I need to raise $1 million for my startup. Can you help me find the money? Because a broker would say, well, it's too expensive to raise money, $1 million for a startup. I don't have the time or effort. There's not enough fees in it for me. It just doesn't. So in other words, startups raise money without the use of intermediaries or brokers almost always. But what they did when they passed the Jobs Act was there was this concern, oh, somebody's going to set up a website to quote unquote crowdfund some nifty thing. They're going to collect a bunch of cash and then they're going to flee the country. And that's going to be bad. And so the federal law required you to go through an intermediary. So you have to use a registered broker dealer or a registered portal. And so both of those requirements under the federal law cost companies a lot of money. So the SEC's proposed Title III regulations speculate that the fees for a portal or a broker dealer are going to be like 8 to 10% of the gross offering amount. So the theory is that, well, if you're going to raise $1 million under the federal law, you're probably going to have to drop like 80 to 100 of that right away on your third-party intermediary, which is really a bummer, right? Because you could use that fee to grow your business, but the government requires you to use a broker. So it's kind of crazy. So what we did in Washington, we did not require the use of an intermediary because most startups don't use an intermediary to raise money. However, when the regulators got a hold of the draft bill, they had the same concern. Well, we can't just let anyone set up a website, raise a bunch of money, and then leave the country. So they required, as a compromise, they said, hey, you're going to have to file paperwork with the state first. We're going to have to review the paperwork and give you approval before you go ahead. So in other words, you're going to have to be in the securities regulatory system before you can proceed. And that's not a bad compromise. That's not a bad compromise at all. It's my real complaint about the regulations in Washington have to do with the required use of an escrow agent. That's one of my big complaints, because it's just hard to find people who will serve as an escrow agent to do these offerings. So it's Oregon, by the way, doesn't require the use of an escrow agent. Oregon's offering amount is smaller. Like, I think it only allows $250,000 to be raised as opposed to $1 million in Washington. But in Oregon, my understanding is you file paperwork, you pay a fee, there's no pre-review by the regulators. There's a time period that has to go by. Like, I think the form has to be filed and the fee has to be paid, and then you have to wait 7 days, but then you can go ahead. And the big question of, like, well, how do we protect consumers? It's a great question, obviously, and we want to protect consumers. But at the same time, like, our fear of protecting consumers can't drive us to basically put in place laws that will never be used, because then we'll never find out. Like, one of these ideas, one of the sort of ideas that sort of informs the whole crowdfunding experiment is this idea that, hey, we're going to have the wisdom of the crowd, right? The wisdom of the crowd is going to inform people when something's a scam. And so I know this has happened on Kickstarter. You know, someone posts on Kickstarter, you know, the perpetual motion machine or something. And it's never like that, but it's some device that's not going to work. And people, I think, do get called out. I think people get called out on Kickstarter, and those campaigns don't succeed because there's a crowd. But the problem under the federal crowdfunding law, and I think this is probably going to, you know, kind of bubble over or also find its way and make it a problem for the state crowdfunding laws, is because of the prohibitions on advertising, you're not going to have this ability for the crowd to observe what's going on and make comments about what's going on, because you're going to have to, there's still prohibitions on advertising, for example. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of like, how do you get like a real free-flowing information discourse going if there are limitations on the movement of information? So it's just kind of, I don't know. It's frustrating to me. I thought one of the benefits of, or one of the primary consumer protection mechanisms was just the limitation on the amount you can invest. So mm-hmm. under the federal law, you're limited per year to I think if your net worth is more than 100 grand or your income is more than 100 grand, under the federal law, you can only put in 10% of your income or net worth during any 12-month period. And if your income is less than 100,000 or your net worth is less than 100,000, you can only put in 5% of that amount. So in my mind, you know, one way to protect consumers is just not to let them lose very much money in these crowdfunding offerings. And in fact, one of the provisions I wrote in the bill that became part of the law in Washington requires investors to sign a statement which basically says, I acknowledge I'm investing in a highly risky venture and I'm very, very likely going to lose all of my money. that actually made it into the final law. So in my opinion, the consumer protection is limit the amount people can put at risk and then make them acknowledge they're probably going to lose their money because most startups fail. And then let the experiment go and see what happens. See if we have an experiment that's worth, you know, allowing to continue. Instead, what we tend to do in the United States is we tend to overreact, and then we put in place laws that basically stamp anything out from happening in the first place, and so we never see what happens. We never let the experiment go.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that it's good to let the experiment go, as you put it. But one thing that occurred to me as you were speaking is, the wisdom of the crowds is one thing, but there's also the complete foolhardiness of the crowd, right? If there's just a lot of buzz around a product or a service or a, you know, non-existent company.
Sure.
That gets people hyped up and they want to be involved. They want to be involved and it really makes no sense whatsoever. And yes, it's not necessarily the government's job to protect people from their own bad judgment, but I think that the whole crowd mentality thing can cut both ways. It can find the more beneficial management teams, and it can let the ones that might wind up losing a whole lot of people a whole lot of money gain a much bigger audience too.
No, it's absolutely true. It's a hard one, right? It's a hard issue to try to figure out, for sure.
Sarah, any more that this is prompting you to want to know about new startup laws about crowdfunding or existing security laws before we move on?
I don't think so. This is totally new to me, so I find it fascinating. But I don't think I have anything further.
All right, well, this just sort of slides into our next topic. You were talking, Joe, about advertising and what an important role that plays in raising money at every stage, and how under our conventional securities laws, that is probably the most regulated part. The way you can communicate with the public is almost non-existent before the JOBS Act. Until you're a public company, when you're raising money in private mode, it's a very tightly regulated affair. How you can communicate, how you can describe your company and what you're doing, and actually raise the money under the JOBS Act and the state laws we've been discussing. That is a more lenient affair. And just in the last week, correct? We have some guidance now from the SEC about startups using Twitter for fundraising. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is one of those examples of, many people get like confused about this area. And it's no surprise that people get confused because there's so many different things going on. So we have this available pathway for companies to raise money called Regulation A. And Regulation A for years had a $5 million limitation cap. So you could only raise up to $5 million under Regulation A. But under old Regulation A, one of the problems was you had to go through a review process at each state. So if you were going to raise money in, say, Washington State from Washington State investors, and you were going to raise money in Oregon, California from investors in Oregon, California, you would have to go through a review process at each state's securities division, and you'd get a bunch of comments back on your offering materials, and you have to incorporate all those comments, and you basically have to get, you know, pre-approved by the regulators before you could go out with your offering materials to investors. And if your funding cap for those offerings was $5 million, it just became completely impractical to follow that process. So no one used Regulation A at all. In fact, reverting back to my comment of 90%+ of offerings were under Rule 506, all accredited offerings, that was the case because, like I described earlier, you could do, you know, a PowerPoint slide deck and a term sheet, get dollars committed by investors, prepare the definitive documents, close on the money, and then file your Form D with the SEC in each state in which you had investors. And that whole process is not horribly expensive from a legal fees point of view. But if you're going to have to draft a very comprehensive disclosure statement, and you're going to have to submit it to each state in which you're going to have investors, and all the securities regulators are going to have to chime in and comment on it, you're going to spend a lot of money on lawyer fees and accounting fees. And then this is before you even know if you're going to be able to raise the money. So that's why no one used Reg A. So mm-hmm. Congress heard that no one used it, and they needed to increase the cap, and so they blew up the cap, and now it's, you know, sometimes colloquially referred to as Reg A plus, because now we can raise more than $5 million. But I think what people need to keep in mind is Reg A still requires a very detailed and comprehensive disclosure doc and be prepared before you go and solicit investors. And so Reg A is still an imperfect vehicle. It will be used by companies that have enough wind in their sails to afford legal and accounting fees to prepare the disclosure statement. And so there might be private companies that are building like medical devices, say, for example, that have already raised a significant amount of money and have the financial wherewithal to draft this Reg A disclosure statement. And so this guidance on the use of Twitter in the Reg A Plus context was very specific to Reg A Plus only. And so if you're like a founder of a company, you know, sitting at WeWork or some other co-working facility in America, and you see the headline come across, hey, we can use Twitter to fundraise, just hit the pause button. you're probably not doing a Reg A Plus offering. If you're reading the headline, you just need to stop, because for the most part, private companies are not going to want to do any kind of public general solicitation of their offerings for the most part still.
Right. All right. So. Very good tip there from our guest, Joe Wong. Read past the headlines and talk to your lawyers before you start tweeting about the money you want to raise.
Yeah. Definitely. And it's really kind of unfortunate because, you know, what you find amongst like the startup founders in America is you find like a very enthusiastic group of people who are like very energetic and who want to move into the future with their product or good or service as quickly as possible. And they believe in the future, and they believe that the future is already here. It just hasn't been well distributed yet, or hasn't been distributed yet, and blah, blah, blah. And so these are people who believe that it's just a matter of time before we can do certain things. But, you know, we have a fairly intense regulatory apparatus in America, which isn't going anywhere. And I think it's, if anything, it's probably going to get worse, which doesn't sound very optimistic, but.
Right. So you would need to, let's just play this out and come up with an SEC-approved tweet. The context in which this would be okay, you would need to be doing a Reg A Plus offering. So you would need to check with your lawyers about that. And then assuming that you passed that hurdle, what could you say in 140 characters or less?
Yeah, I think the guidance says you've got to make reference to some underlying regulatory sort of mandatory disclosures. And anyway, I quoted in full the guidance on my blog post about it. I think, you know, more interesting for startup companies is we started to talk about this before in the crowdfunding context, but more interesting, I think, than Reg A Plus is Rule 506C. And so Rule 506C is the regulatory rule that came out of Section 201 of the Jobs Act. So we were talking about this before. In the Jobs Act, Congress heard from company founders that, hey, look, you know, we're limited in how we can communicate with prospective investors because of these old rules prohibiting advertising or the use of the internet to talk about offerings. And that really slows the innovation economy down. And so you should let us use social media to talk to prospective investors. And Congress said, okay, sure. And so Section 201 of the Jobs Act, as initially drafted, simply said, hey, as long as you're taking money from only accredited investors, you can go ahead and advertise. And they instructed the SEC to remove the prohibition on advertising in all accredited investor offerings. But then what happened is during the House hearing in which this rule was being, or this proposed piece of legislation was being discussed, one of the members of the House committee that was hearing testimony on this prospective section of the Jobs Act raised his or her hand, I forgot who it was exactly, and said, hey, look, you know, it concerns me that we're going to let companies advertise because I'm afraid that even though it's supposed to be limited to accredited investors only, I'm afraid with the advertising, with the general solicitation, non-accredited people might get roped in and they might lose their money and that would be unfair for them. So I think we should impose some verification requirement that companies have to, you know, undergo to verify that these people are in fact accredited investors. And everyone at the, you know, in the committee hearing room sort of nodded their head and said, oh, yeah, some reasonable verification requirement. That sounds reasonable. And so they added like a sentence which said the SEC shall adopt, you know, some rules regarding verification of accredited investor status. And then what happened was the SEC then issues rules which say, oh, investors are going to have to turn over their tax returns or their personal financial statements to verify that they're accredited. And so all of a sudden we go from a rule which is supposed to be like, you know, making life easier for companies to raise money, and we have like, you know, some incidental language added to the statute, which no one thinks is going to result in what it results in, which is the SEC saying, oh, angel investors, you're going to, if it's a publicly solicited offering, you're going to have to give up your tax return and or your personal financial statements to these startup companies so they can verify you're accredited. And so all of a sudden, like what we thought was going to be a great innovation in the law turns out to be completely unutilized almost because this is difficult and no one wants to do this. Right. So I think, anyway, getting back to Reg A Plus, the use of Twitter, I think there have been a couple private companies, well-known private companies that have done 506C offerings recently. One is a company called Buffer, which is a really cool social media management tool. Maybe you've used it, Denise. It's pretty neat. The Buffer app is a pretty cool tool. So the Buffer company did its Series A publicly. And then Dave McClure's new, you know, 500 Startups Venture Fund generally solicited its latest fund. So there have been a couple of prominent 506C offerings. And it might be that over time, investors get more comfortable with this idea of verification of their accredited investor status. And there is a mechanism built into the rules to allow third parties like lawyers and accountants. So instead of you, Denise, having to fork over your tax returns to the three software developers in the garage who are in their 20s, there is a rule accommodates the idea of, no, Denise, you can give your tax returns to your broker, and your broker can then send a letter to the three software engineers in the garage verifying that he, your broker, looked at your financial statements or your tax returns and is verifying that you meet the standards. So maybe over time this becomes more popular. I personally think Congress should just do a Jobs Act 2.0 and Congress should repeal that additional verification requirement. And then I think also Congress should substantially simplify Title III. But, you know,
this is exactly what you have to do, Joe. You have to draft it, post it to your blog. Go speak in Washington on regulatory issues.
Sure.
And hand it off to a lawmaker and let it go.
Yeah, sure. Sounds reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to put our first MCLE passphrase into our show. It's going to be enthusiastic founders. We put these phrases in for people who are listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit. If you need more information about that, please go to wiki.twit.tv and find our This Week in Law page there. We can roll along accordingly and put another one of these phrases in the show later on in case you need to verify that you actually watched or listened to the show. We're also going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which logically enough involves getting you money based on everything we've been talking about. It is Braintree. It's code for easy online payments. If you're a mobile app developer, check out Braintree. Braintree is the payment solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to the successful companies they are today. So Braintree can scale with your business too, from processing your first dollar to your billionth, no matter how a customer would like to pay you. And we all know that we all like to pay in various ways. Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problem of the mobile cart abandonment issue by offering best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Check it out for yourself. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all types your customers might want. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration across all platforms. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To learn more and for your first 50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twill. That's braintreepayments.com/twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for making it easy to get paid and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Sarah, anything you wanted to chime in on or add or ask before we move along here and talk about Uber?
I don't think so.
All right. Thanks so much for the crowdfunding primer. Joe, that's been really fascinating. We know it's an important area and very much still in flux. So hopefully we can have you back on maybe next year at this time. And sure. You can bring us up to speed on whether anything has happened. Again, in the 3 years since the passage of the Jobs Act, it's been interesting to keep track and see how it's actually coming into play. But let's talk about Uber. Uber and other sharing economy companies are in a morass of regulatory problems themselves. And in particular, there was a finding. It was sort of a small administrative judge finding in California. It's really advisory in nature. It really doesn't have a whole lot of impact, but you wouldn't know that from the way it's been received. I think it's being viewed as the tip of the iceberg of characterizing sharing economy workers as employees and not contractors. The ruling in question was from the California Labor Commissioner's office. And again, they issued an advisory opinion that involved reimbursement of expenses because a driver in question who worked for Uber submitted some expenses, and the labor commissioner said, yeah, she's looking like an employee here and she should be reimbursed. Now, the New York Times has written this up and various other outlets are looking at this as a harbinger of Uber contractors being characterized as employees. And there are various lawsuits pending. Lyft is being sued in Florida. This is just a very hot issue right now, whether people that these sharing economy companies have been treating as contractors. And again, this is done for expense and regulatory reasons. It's cheaper to have a fleet of contractors working for you, and there are far fewer regulatory hoops to jump through than it is to have a staff of employees who you have to, you know, depending on the size of your company, provide with various services and benefits and information. So, Sarah, we've had this on the roster to talk about for quite some time. What do you think, if you're willing to ballpark this, is going to happen here? And what do you think the fallout stands to be?
Ooh, I hate to make a prediction. I guess, in the past couple of weeks, probably I've read a lot about this. And the most interesting piece I read was in The New Yorker by the economist at The New Yorker. And he talked a lot, I thought, really persuasively about how, you know, the fact is that there are good arguments on both sides in terms of it is unfortunate if, you know, companies like Uber are going to classify people as contractors simply to minimize costs. But on the other side of the coin, it's actually not in probably the vast majority of Uber drivers' best interest to be classified as contractors, to be classified as employees, because it would increase costs so much for Uber that they would just have a smaller workforce, and those people wouldn't end up even being able to work for Uber anymore. So I thought that was really interesting. And he talked about how, you know, the problem is our categories just don't make sense anymore. And how, you know, maybe the solution, and I don't know how realistic this is, but to me it seems quite practical, is to actually reconsider our categories, and maybe we need to redefine them, or maybe we need to add a third one that is some sort of kind of confluence of, has some pieces of the contractor and some pieces of the employee, but it doesn't impose the same, it's not, you know, as black and white. So that would be what I would like to see happen. Whether or not that will be the case, I don't know. I don't want to wager a guess, but it sounds like that has been happening in some countries around the world. They have actually been thinking about defining new categories and rewriting their laws. And it seems to me like that makes a lot of sense. But
well, this is actually a great topic for us to take up right after talking about these crowdfunding laws, because it seems like a very parallel situation to me, where traditionally our economy and employment practices have supported one model, and things are shifting, and maybe the laws that have existed for so long don't really deal very well with the shift. You have, in today's economy, people having perhaps multiple ways that they make money and not just one job, and that's a good situation to support. And as Sarah was saying, you want them to be able to pursue whatever gainful employment makes sense to them without having to worry about this employer-employee designation and how that might possibly cut them off from a source of livelihood. So this is another area where the law is really in flux, and I think the policymakers are going to have to look hard at how we can go ahead and let people be employed and paid and also protected. I mean, you don't want to have companies taking advantage of people who technically are working for them full time but are not treated as employees. Joe, this must come up in your practice quite a bit as you work with startups, and startups grapple with this issue. You know, how are we going to treat our employees? How are we going to hire them and pay them? So what's your take?
Well, I mean, I think if Congress really wanted to do something for workers in America, Congress would repeal the tax on stock transfers to workers. And one of the things that really harms workers in America today is that if their employer wants to give them stock in the employer company, an outright stock transfer to the worker is treated as if it was a cash transfer equal to the value of the stock. And so what this effectively does is it prohibits workers from being able to accept stock transfers because they can't afford the taxes on the stock transfers. So say, for example, Denise, say you had a startup company, say the two of you had a company, mm-hmm. you and Sarah, and you were going to hire me and you wanted to give me 10% of the company, and the company was currently valued at $1 million, so you wanted to give me $100,000 worth of stock, and I was going to be an employee. Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't actually afford to accept it because I would have to write a check to your company to cover the income and employment tax withholding that is my responsibility, and the amount of that check would have to be on the order of something like $30,000. And most workers in America don't have $30,000 sitting around to write a check to the IRS when they receive illiquid stock in a private company. And so I would have to say, Denise, shoot, that's really nice of you to offer me 10% of the company in stock. And I know I would be better off as a human being and a worker if I could accept that without the taxes, but I can't afford the taxes and therefore I can't participate in that way in your company. And then you'd have mm-hmm. to find an alternative method to compensate me. You'd probably give me a stock option priced at fair market value so it wouldn't have any gain in it. And I would mm-hmm. only be able to participate in the gain if there was gain later and I continued to work for the company, and options expire upon 90 days of termination. And anyway, so I think doing things for workers in America is a great idea. But I think what Congress should do is they should say, hey, look, we're not going to tax transfers of illiquid stock to workers because they're illiquid transfers. They're not cash transfers. And we want workers to participate in the equity of these companies because that's where people really can make money. And that's what really can make people better off. So in any event, that's my 2 cents on how to make workers better off. I do think obviously the independent contractor employee thing, it's been a quagmire for a long time. It's not new to the sharing economy. I mean, this has been an mm-hmm. issue that's been kicking around for a long time. And sure. From the regulator's point of view, I mean, I think the recent Labor Department guidance basically said something like, hey, you know, I think they said something like, most workers are employees under our definitions. Under the Fair Labor Standard Act definitions, most workers are employees. And I know for certain that that's been sort of the regulatory viewpoint for a long time. Mm-hmm. And but there are other ways to look at this too. So for example, if I am an employee of a company and I incur expenses which aren't reimbursed expenses in the course of my employment, I'm not going to be able to deduct those expenses unless and until they exceed 2% of my AGI. So as a worker, I get jammed. If I incur mm-hmm. non-reimbursed expenses, I effectively can't deduct them because of the way the tax law works. I think, you know, there needs to be some changes in the law to accommodate the practical reality on the ground, which is that people need to make a living. People right. like to make a living in a way that gives them flexibility. I've talked to lots of Uber drivers and they like the idea of, hey, if I want to work, I can work, and if I don't want to work, I don't have to work. They like that. I mean, we should do things that the workers in America like. And I can tell you for certain that workers like flexibility. And so I'm not sure why we wouldn't accord them flexibility. Anyway.
Sorry, I was just going to jump into this. I mean, to say, I think one thing is that the stakes are somewhat high in the U.S. at least, in terms of if you're, you know, employment is how we basically provide medical care for, you know, our population. And so not being an employee has serious, of a company has serious real life consequences. And I agree that there are lots of Uber drivers that do it part-time and they're not relying on it for healthcare. But I think to me that's that, and I mean, there's medical care and there's retirement benefits are often tied to your employment. So it's, in that way, to me, I think it is kind of, the stakes are pretty high and if you're not an employee. The other thing I was thinking is, I guess with the stock options, I don't know much about that, but to me, that doesn't seem like it would affect the vast majority of quote unquote workers in the U.S. I think of stock options as being something, or not stock options, but getting equity as being something that would be for the highest echelon of workers, not like the vast majority. But maybe it's because of the tax implications, but I don't know, I'm a bit skeptical, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think, one, many startup companies offer equity awards to almost all of their worker base. And for the most part with startup companies, those equity awards are options because those can be granted without tax consequences to the worker. Yeah. And of course, it's one of these classic, you know, scenarios again, where we're never going to find out what would happen if we allowed transfers of stock to workers to occur without triggering tax, unless we allow it to happen and see what happens. I mean, we can build an economic model and say, well, gee, you know, if we repealed this tax on stock transfers to workers, what would happen? And we can speculate about what would happen. But, you know, frequently economic models that predict outcomes, you know, based on changes of the law and so on and so forth, just are wrong. They don't turn out to be right. And so how are we going to know what's going to happen unless we allow it to happen? And by the way, I just don't see any downside to allowing corporate America to issue stock to workers so workers can participate in the increase in the value of the stock. I mean, why not allow companies to share equity more broadly with workers? Wouldn't that be good for workers overall in America? I think it would be.
So there's a really interesting article that Joe pointed us to before the show, and I'm going to point you to, by Cyrus Farivar at Ars Technica. With a great headline, "Watch out, sharing economy. The feds are watching this whole contractor thing." Talking about this new policy guidance that was released earlier by the Department of Labor. And it basically, as Joe was saying, was a shot across the bow saying, listen, companies, here's exactly what they say. Misclassification of employees as independent contractors is found in an increasing number of workplaces in the United States, in part reflecting larger restructuring of business organizations. When employers improperly classify employees as independent contractors, the employees may not receive important workplace protections such as minimum wage, overtime compensation, unemployment insurance, and workers' compensation. Misclassification also results in lower tax revenues for the government and an uneven playing field for employers who properly classify their workers. Although independent contracting relationships can be advantageous for workers and businesses, some employees may be intentionally misclassified as a means to cut costs and avoid compliance with labor laws. Now, let's see, who exactly is this guy? Michael Leroy is a labor law professor at the University of Illinois. He goes on to call this the opening brief in the Department of Labor's push to bring a complaint against Uber and other similar firms. So he is guessing that aside from the various lawsuits we've seen crop up against these companies of whether it's trying to get treated as a class action or individual employees seeking overtime or reimbursement of expenses, that kind of thing, that the U.S. Department of Labor may well be contemplating a larger action here. Sarah, do you think that would have a real chilling effect, or do you think people would just reclassify?
I don't know. I think it would certainly be, I don't know. I don't have a prediction.
There's a reason that businesses are pursuing this path. It lets them operate leaner and meaner. So we'll just have to see if they're able to continue. Joe, any final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, like, I think the broader issue is like, hey, how do we improve, worker welfare overall? And so we shouldn't look at it through the very narrow prism of worker classification. We should look at it more broadly. And, the comment made earlier about health insurance is a really good one. I mean, I'm not sure why in America, workers get like the worst possible like treatment in healthcare when we have retirees, people who are no longer working, getting a great deal. I'm not sure why what workers wouldn't get a better deal in terms of how they're treated for healthcare purposes than retirees. And I think it harms workers to be bound to an employer for their healthcare. I think workers would be better off if their healthcare went with them wherever they went, whatever job. And I don't know. I think we should try to empower workers, make life better for them. I think we should look at it from their point of view, not from the point of view of the corporations or the government. We should look at it from the point of view of the worker.
I completely agree.
I guess an excellent point. Go ahead, Sarah.
I was going to say, I've always kind of had a hard time understanding why it's in corporations' interest to carry the burden of healthcare either. And maybe it's not, but you don't see many, I don't know, it seems like they would be lobbying for kind of disaggregating healthcare from the employment relationship, because that's a huge cost for companies.
Yeah, although it does tie the worker to the company, which is, I guess, good for the company, because now the worker is tied to you in some more meaningful way.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, and that's what, again, this is something Joe pointed us to right before the show, that some companies are making the shift to classifying, some sharing economy companies are making the shift to classifying their workers as employees rather than independent contractors. Ship is a courier company. It's a startup that picks up packages and ships items on demand. And they have announced that in order to have a longer term relationship with their couriers, they will all be treated as employees. They are employees. So this may be something that we see more and more of, both from I think there are all kinds of benefits to it. Obviously, there's a public relations benefit. There's a longer-term relationship benefit with the people working with you. And there's the fact that you're going to not be in the sights of the Department of Labor and others. So this is something we might see more of. All right. I think we should take a break and thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. After our break, we'll move on to Happy Birthday and Facebook video and some other stories. But before we get there, I want you to stand up and stretch. You've been sitting down for the whole show, and think about how much more comfortable you would be working all day at your desk if you didn't have to stand up and stretch all the time. If you could stand on your feet while you were working. And Varidesk is something that you should check out if you've been thinking about getting a standing desk or wondering whether one would be good for you. Because if you're like the average worker, you probably spend at least 5 hours and 41 minutes sitting at your desk every day. And we all know that being sedentary isn't good for you. According to research conducted by the Mayo Clinic, it's putting you at much greater risk, actually, for a whole range of health problems and shortening your lifespan. So you've probably heard about the benefits of a standing desk, and that's why we're telling you today about Varidesk. Varidesk offers a variety of height-adjustable desks that let you easily switch between sitting and standing. And unlike other options, you don't have to get rid of your existing desk. This is the best thing about the Varidesk. It goes right on top of your existing desk. It converts your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk with no assembly, installation, or even boss approval required. It comes fully assembled. Just pull it out of the box, put it on your desk, and place your monitors and gear on it. You'll be ready to work in no time. Then when you want to stand, you simply raise the Varidesk by using the convenient handles on either side. The spring-loaded boost mechanism makes raising your monitors and keyboard effortless. Varidesk is adjustable with 11 different height settings. And because Varidesk sits on top of your existing workspace, it's more affordable and easier to set up than other standing desks. Prices start as low, in fact, as $275 plus shipping. Lifehacker included Varidesk in their 5 Best Standing Desks guide, and it also has been featured on Product Hunt and Gear Patrol. We've got a Varidesk Pro Plus 36 in the Twit Brick House, and now everybody wants one. I know I'm jealous because I'm down in Southern California and don't get to use it. So if you're like me and you're very interested in how this Varidesk thing might work, you're going to want to go to Varidesk.com to learn more about it and check out their whole range of height adjustable desks for your desk or cubicle. And when you purchase a Varidesk, be sure to tell them that you heard about it on our network right here, the Twit Network. That's Varidesk.com, V-A-R-I-Desk.com. Thank you so much for your support of our backs and of This Week in Law. All right. right. So I think we will move on to talk about something potentially quite happy in the arena of entertainment and music. So if you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know that the song Happy Birthday to You is the subject of much copyright controversy. Specifically, Warner Chappell claims to hold the copyright to the song and will come after you if you put it in anything that they uncover and object to. They have been rather vigorous about that. So there has been a lawsuit pending about it's a documentary film that has been brought proactively to it's about the song Happy Birthday to You. And the plaintiffs, the filmmakers there, are suing Warner Chappell for the right to use the song in the documentary. And they claim they don't need to pay any license fees. They claim they have had various arguments along the way about the song being in the public domain and not subject to copyright at all. And now there is, you know, one of these dramatic litigation discovery moments has occurred in their case. Something was produced from the 1920s. The particular document that was produced in the case was published in 1927. They found an earlier version, having done some more research, that was published in 1922. It was published by, I don't know if it's Warner Chappell itself or its predecessor and, you know, whoever it got the rights from. And it included Happy Birthday without any copyright notice. And the plaintiffs are arguing that these lyrics were dedicated to the public domain many, many years before the copyright registration that Warner Chappell relies upon for its copyright. So I'm very excited to talk about the Happy Birthday song on this day that is actually, I think we've decided it's the dog's birthday, Carmel, our little show mascot, who's not here with us. I always send her off while we do the show. So you can, you know, wish her a happy birthday and I will convey your good wishes along to her. Today is National Mutt Day. So that's the day that we always say is her birthday. She was born around now 2 years ago. So Sarah, is this a big deal? Do you think this smoking gun might carry the day in this case?
It seems like it might. I was going to say that I still am mad. So about 3 years ago, I said to my husband, who's also a lawyer, we have to find a plaintiff and bring this case against Happy Birthday. You know, mm-hmm. to prove that it's in the public domain, because I think I read something about it and thought it was crazy that it was copyrighted. And then, you know, mm-hmm. maybe a year later, somebody took it. And now I think it seems like they're going to be successful. I think it's awesome. But yeah, I think it sounds like it really is kind of a smoking gun. I think I was trying to, you know, figure out from some of the articles what the arguments were by Warner Chappell, you know, as to... First of all, I guess why they just now unearthed the evidence, because I think one thing was this should have come out in discovery in, you know, a year ago, and it just now mm-hmm. came out. I guess they just found it. So they're not trying to suppress the evidence, which is good, but they are arguing that there's still an issue of fact. And then what they're saying is that the Hill sisters, who are the women who everyone agrees, you know, originally wrote the lyrics to the song, and I believe the song itself, that they didn't necessarily give authorization for this, for having the song included in this book, the songbook. And so they're saying mm-hmm. there's still an issue of fact there for a jury. So that I can't, it's kind of an unusual, and it was hard to piece together how that argument works, because even the songbook that was unearthed, this piece of evidence, has language on there that says special permission was given through the courtesy of this company that apparently was assigned the copyright. So I don't know how they've argued that away. I wasn't able to read their full brief to kind of figure out what the argument was there. But apparently there's some semblance of an argument that there may still be a fact issue there. But certainly this mm-hmm. looks really quite good for the people challenging the copyright, for sure. So
Right. And you have to take your hat off to Good Morning to You Productions, the plaintiff in this case, run by director of this documentary, Jennifer Nelson, who filed this suit over $1,500, basically. She was told she'd have to pay that to include the song in her film. And you know that bringing this suit since 2013, now it's been pending, has cost her well more than that. But potentially has the opportunity to establish that the song is in the public domain for good and all. So we will continue to watch it. There's no resolution yet, but just this new document that could carry the day in the lawsuit. Joe, do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh, you know, no, not really. Other than I wonder if someone could like kickstart a, you know, use Kickstarter to like fund litigation or something over things like this that would be of interest to many people. But I don't know.
Oh, absolutely.
Probably some ethical rule against that.
I don't think so. Adam Carolla pretty successfully raised money from listeners to contest or to help him contest a podcasting related patent matter. Oh. So I do think that, it can be done. It certainly has been done. I don't know, you know, if there are things that regulators would have to say about it, quite possibly. But it's not a novel idea. And, I don't think the Adam Carolla example is the only one. All right. Well, so we'll continue to, you know, cross our fingers that we'll be able to sing happy birthday on the show and not have to worry about getting licensing to do so. In the meantime, let's take a look real quick at Facebook and what it's doing with video. This is a story that caught my eye over the last week. We've talked before about how Facebook is really pushing itself as a video platform, an alternative to YouTube, and is doing lots of things to encourage people to not just link over to YouTube videos, but to upload things natively to Facebook. Now they've put a splash screen that comes up when you're going to post a link that says, consider uploading your video directly to Facebook. People are more likely to view native videos and you'll be able to track your success in Page Insights. So they're trying to give more analytics. The major complaint is that as an advertising and money-making platform, they're not where YouTube is. And also, we talked very recently on the show about how people will take videos from other sources and upload them natively to Facebook, and that's a real problem there, too. So an interesting footnote to this story, which was published at thenextweb.com by Owen Williams, is that Owen got in touch with Facebook and got some insight from them about their content ID system, how they're dealing with copyrighted videos that are up on their site in an unauthorized way. Of course, this has been a huge deal for YouTube. And they've come out and said that they've used Audible Magic for years to prevent unauthorized video content and have reporting tools in place to allow the reporting by an owner of the use of their video. Also, they have flagging tools in place where users can let them know about suspected infringing videos, etc. They call it a significant technical challenge to solve, but they have a team working on it and expect to have more to share this summer. Again, an interesting thing to watch as Facebook grapples with turning itself into more of a video platform. Sarah, any thoughts?
I think so. I guess I'll do a prediction on this one. I wouldn't for mm-hmm. Uber, but my guess is that that YouTube is going to try to strike a deal with Facebook, and I think it will be interesting to see whether or not Facebook will do that. And I have no idea what that will look like, but that would be my guess. And from the creator perspective, I think creators are going to maybe stop tying their sales so closely to YouTube and try to find ways to make money through Facebook as well. But the interesting thing will be how the platforms end up, if they just end up trying to duke it out, or if they work out some sort of collaboration that allows them both to take a cut of videos and work together. I don't know. That would be my guess. But
right. We'll see. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you meant a deal about revenue sharing on ads, or a deal about, because YouTube obviously has a far more sophisticated content ID system. So giving Facebook some of that technology and insight, I guess it could look any number of ways.
Yeah, I could see it being maybe revenue sharing, or maybe just a way to that both platforms somehow get, that Facebook somehow gives a nod back to YouTube, and then they'd have to get some sort of benefit in return, though, and that would be the interesting thing. I assume it would be ad revenue, but I don't know exactly.
All right. Hey, Joe, any thoughts about Facebook video?
Oh, no, other than that, it'll be fun to watch. you know what I mean? It'll be fun to watch and see what happens. I guess I'm sort of late to the party, but YouTube is a pretty amazing place, right, in terms of just stuff. And maybe I'm just like really displaying my whatever, how out of it I am. But I mean, YouTube is pretty amazing. So it'll be fun to see if Facebook can do something comparable.
Yeah, it sure will. All right. What did we say? YouTube has some fun stuff. Let's make fun stuff our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And let's thank our final sponsor for this episode of the show, which is ZipRecruiter. This is such a cool tool. You really have to check it out, because here we are in the middle of summer, and summer is absolutely the best time to hire the best people. I'm not sure you'd have to look at the cultural data and statistics, but just anecdotally, it seems to me like everyone shifts jobs and moves in the summer. It probably has to do with the fact that people wait until their children have a break from school to move around the country, etc. But that makes it a great opportunity for you if you're a business who's looking to hire. Competitors are on vacation in the summer. People who are working are looking to shift around, move around. So there's far less competition for quality candidates, and the candidates are out there looking for work. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find those quality candidates, though. And short staffing, of course, everyone's short staffed, leaves little time to post to dozens and dozens of job sites. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100 plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 4 million resumes. So think of it as an online dating site that matches up your business with compatible employees. Just post once, and within 24 hours, you can watch your candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Now, there are many, many happy ZipRecruiter clients, but Tara is one such client, and she said ZipRecruiter has completely changed the way we evaluate and manage candidates. As a small business, we subscribe to the always be hiring approach to growth, and the tools available to us through our membership have made that simpler, easier, and faster. So if you're like Tara and want to have an easy way to always be hiring, you can try out ZipRecruiter absolutely for free. Go to ziprecruiter.com/twit. That's ziprecruiter.com/twit. Thank you so much, ZipRecruiter, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's end the show talking about some copyright stories. Sarah, let's talk about the topic that we love to revisit from time to time on the show, the copyright ability of tweets. Apparently, people go on Twitter to try and be funny. this is a thing. This happens. And once you've been funny on Twitter, your funny line is out there in 140 characters or less. And it's not uncommon for people who are trying to build up their follower counts to just wholesale adopt your funny tweet and post it to their account. Twitter is cracking down on that. And actually, Conan O'Brien is being targeted in a lawsuit that claims he lifted a joke from Twitter. So we're back to this conundrum of whether tweets are even copyrightable. In the context of a joke, do you think they are?
Ooh, I think it's entirely possible that there are creative enough quotes or tweets that would be copyrightable. Just considering the things out there that are considered copyrightable, that seems so uncreative. And I've seen a lot of tweets that, you know, really catch your eye as being funny or, you know, creative in some way. It seems possible. Just as you were kind of teeing this up, I was remembering, wasn't there something in the last year or so where somebody applied to the Copyright Office for registration on tweets and they were denied? But that of course doesn't mean much other than those particular tweets weren't considered to be copyrightable. But, and I might be misremembering, I wish I would have remembered that before I would have looked it up. But to me, it seems at least theoretically possible that they would be copyrightable. The joke thing, that I have a harder time with, especially, you know, from the article about the Conan O'Brien case, and I haven't read any of the legal documentation at this point, but it sounded like Conan changed the jokes. You know, he took the idea of the joke and changed it slightly. And that, to me, that's the classic. I don't know how that could possibly be a copyright violation. You know, you can't copyright ideas. Maybe there's some sort of unfair competition claim or something. But if it's a matter of copyright, I guess I have a really hard time seeing how that would be a legitimate claim. But
Yeah, and Twitter apparently has a mechanism in place now where you can turn someone in if you think that they're doing what I described before and lifting a tweet. You know, say you've had a particularly clever moment and it has been retweeted and favorited all over the place, and then you spot it on someone else's account. Twitter apparently will hide that tweet and as also referred to people who are reporting such things as the copyright holders in their own tweets. So we'll continue to watch this unfold. Joe, any thoughts about this?
No, I don't have any thoughts about this. I don't know what to say. I
have
no,
all right.
No comments.
All right. Well, if you tweet that, we'll make sure that you get proper attribution for it.
Exactly.
Sarah, I think you put this one in our rundown by Michael Weinberg, who is now working at Shapeways. I did not know that. We've had him on the show before. He is a huge expert in 3D printing and was formerly with Public Knowledge. So he has posted a great piece on the intense desire to license or what he has learned during his first 4 months at Shapeways. Did you have some takeaways here that you wanted to highlight for us?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I think Parker Higgins from EFF tweeted about it. I think his overall takeaway was kind of, you know, this idea that we have about the DMCA takedown system. We always think about people as it being very black and white. Either somebody is, you know, this relentless pirate, or they're this kind of aggrieved free speaker who's being unfairly, you know, slapped down through a takedown. And he was saying that in his experience, and I think he's only been there 4 months or so at Shapeways, is that there is some truth in those, but there's also this huge gray area where people know that they're doing something that they need permission for, but they have no way of getting a hold of the rights holder. And so the takedown actually becomes a way for them to get the attention of the rights holder and then work out some sort of license. Whether or not that many rights holders end up going for that, I don't know. But I thought that was really, to me, that was really interesting. And it fits in with a lot of the thinking that we do at Creative Commons, because you know, we try to encourage people to think about ways that sharing your work and allowing people to do things, especially outside of the commercial context, you know, having your fans spread the word about what you do can actually be beneficial to the rights holder themselves. So to me, I just saw a lot of familiar themes, and I thought it was interesting that he was seeing that play out in the real world in practice. So,
yeah, that it's a great piece, and folks should check it out. We are posting. I'm trying out a new bookmark manager. It is called TagPacker. So if you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, you're going to find all the links that we've been referring to in the show today, including Michael Weinberg's piece. And you're going to find our resource and tip of the week there as well. Our resource of the week is a... something that it's a summary of something that happened in June. Coincidentally enough, it has to do with the sharing economy. There was an FTC roundtable that it involved the sharing economy. It was a workshop. It discussed a lot of the things we've discussed on the show today. This was written up by attorney John Feldman, who I take it attended this event, and sort of blogged the highlights of it. It's interesting in how the FTC is viewing some of the issues that we talked about today, some of the other issues that have to do with privacy. They're considering regulation of the sharing economy in various facets. So there are some great bits of insight here for folks that are interested in that, including how one speaker thought that Uber might actually be more trustworthy than, say, the Toronto taxi system for taking children around, because Uber's inherent lack of privacy allows one to see where your kids are the entire time, as well as who's driving them. So some considerations like that are all written up here. I encourage you to check it out. And our tip of the week is a reminder about tweeting or Instagramming or otherwise sharing photos when you're doing so as an incentive to perhaps get something for free. A couple of cautionary things there. Number one, of course, has to do with the, it's the FCC, I believe. No, it's the FTC. Sorry, I misspoke. FTC that regulates what's an ad and what is not, and what needs to be disclosed as an ad. And so you might not think that, you know, if you're in a restaurant and they told you, hey, you know, we'll give you a free dessert if you tweet a picture of our menu, or, you know, there are all kinds of promotional things where you may be getting a freebie for tweeting a picture of something. And actually, technically, under the FTC's guidelines, these photos for freebies deals may be considered ads, and you might find yourself on the wrong end of a fine for this sort of thing. So Professor Eric Goldman has written up on his blog at Forbes a great piece on Instagramming for freebies. I encourage you to check that out if you need more information. The other tip involved here is sort of a twofold tip. Is be careful if you are the Instagrammer. Also be careful if you're the business offering these kinds of rewards for customers or users to tweet pictures in exchange for things, because not only might you be on the wrong side of the FTC's advertising rules, but you might also be on the wrong side of various sweepstakes and contest rules in every state if you are picking a winner, for example, best picture of our fabulous dessert and awarding a prize, that might well constitute a sweepstakes or a contest. And those are pretty tightly regulated too. So just bear that in mind as you're going about your social media life. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. Joe Wallen, it's been so great chatting with you. I learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners and viewers did too. Is there anything going on in Seattle or with your practice that you want to let us know about before we go ahead and wrap the show?
Oh, thanks for asking. You know, just Seattle's great this time of year. If you have a chance, come visit. It's awesome. It's awesome here. Now's the time to visit. Come before, you know, like the third week in October. I mean, we're good. We're golden on great weather until like sometime in like the second or third week of October. Then it turns kind of gray and rainy for like, I don't know, until like May.
8 months or something.
But right now, it's just incredible place to live. It's just the best place. Well, it's a great place to live. So come visit now. That would be a good time.
Perfect. Everyone drop in on Joe. You can, you know, no doubt find his Airbnb listing and crash in the in the spare bedroom. Sure. All right, Joe, it's been wonderful having you on the show. And also I wanted to mention again your Law of Startups blog and podcast, which is if you need more information about the kinds of things we were talking about at the top of the show, excellent resource for your startup law needs. Sarah, great chatting with you again this week.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was lots of fun.
All right. Thanks, and Sarah. Folks, as thanks. I mentioned, oh, sure. My
thanks.
Pleasure.
Thanks. It's fun to be on the show.
Delightful to do the show with you both. Folks, if you have joined us on Friday, that means you tuned in at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC to watch us live. That is when we record the show live, and it's always fun to have you join us then if you can. But if you can't, don't worry. You can find the show at twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive is there, as well as many tips and pointers on how you can enjoy the show on whatever device your little heart desires at whatever time your little heart desires. So go check that out. Again, we're trying out Tag Packer for our discussion points for the show. So the username there is This Week in Law. And also we have, of course, you can hit up Sarah and me on Twitter anytime. She is S. Hinch Pearson there. I'm D. Howell there. You can email Sarah at sarahp@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. And you can find our Facebook and Google Plus pages and communities as well to send us suggestions, feedback, reactions to stories that we've discussed, things you want to see us discuss in the future. We'd love to hear from you. And seriously, we couldn't do the show if we didn't get your great suggestions and feedback about what you like and what you think we should be paying attention to. So please keep them coming. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.